Well, hello, everyone, and thanks, Darren, for popping into the channel to hang out for a bit. You want to go ahead and introduce yourself?
Happy to be here. Yeah, I'm Darren from Grimerica, the Grimerica Show on, I think, just about every place now. We've been doing it a long time, so I think we're just about every place, been kicked off most places, and found our way back. It seemed like it seems like the censorship is down for now, for certain things at least.
Yeah, it does. I'd have to agree that, you see the comedians talking about how you can say retard again, and it's not like it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
Although
exactly. I might just got demonetized for saying it so early in the video, but whatever. The culture's, I talk a lot about how pendulum swings back and forth and never stops in the middle, and we're definitely seeing a bit of that now. But I do feel like with comedy, for example, I feel like it has gotten smarter. Like the whole woke pushing against it 10 to 15 years ago, and then the kind of the pushback has got where you don't see, like, we see a lot of racial humor, but I wouldn't say racist humor, if that makes sense. Like, we see a lot of jokes about stereotypes, but we don't see jokes that are like, these guys suck because of X, Y, or Z, where you kind of, like, you look at some of the stuff I grew up with, it was like, holy shit, man, if you watch that guy, that was a little blatant.
Yeah, it's good to see the comedians come back.
Oh, man, I love
it. It is good to see them. I mean, we need them sort of be the front line, I guess, really. They've always sort of been the tip of the spear for free speech. Podcasts and stuff now, too, but it's like a different world because we're just on the podcast. You know, you get the YouTube stuff, you get kicked off of there, but you can pretty much say whatever you want on a podcast, at least for now, and not get into too much trouble or even get just, I think what the other thing with the podcast is that, I mean, you tend to get a lot of haters, but for the most part, there's so much variety out there that it's like, if someone's listening to your stuff, it's because they picked you. You know, it's not just because you're what's on that channel at that time and there's nothing else on. That's sort of the one thing in the era of infinite content, is that you got to assume that the people that are watching you regularly like your stuff because they have like unlimited opportunity to go watch something else.
Yeah, that was one of my first big epiphanies as a YouTuber, was when I was just like, I'm not just competing with, Ben Van Kirkwith and the Grimerica Show. I'm competing with fucking Bill Gates and freaking The Doors and funny cat videos and kids getting, hitting people in the balls with the baseball bat. It's like, oh man, shit, this is.
And the algos.
The algorithm will just bury you. I had one of my videos recently that was just tickling me to death. It was like, click through rate's good, watch time's good. And it says, but the problem is this is a content that's not very interesting to your normal viewer or something like that. So we're not sharing it as much. I forget the exact message, but I'm sure you've seen it on YouTube. And it's just hilarious because it was on the second Sphinx. And it's like, they're telling me, yeah, my followers hate Egypt.
We after we got demonetized a couple times now, I just assume we don't really have any traction on YouTube. We kind of do it there because you sort of have to be there.
We
do go through little burps where we get a bunch of followers. I mean, we had stalled out at like 10,000 or 11,000 for like almost a decade, and then it just slowly started ticking back up again. You know what it was? Is it really seems like a lot of the stuff. I mean, the Twitter account was 2 days after Trump's inauguration. Yeah. Literally 2 days after and I had been kicked off Twitter for 2.5 years. Since 2022. And I was like, and I had like given up on appealing. I'd like appealed so many times, and then Elon had bought the company, and it was because technically it was Elon's Twitter that kicked me off. It was like, I can't blame Elon because I think it was like a week after he bought the place, but it was under Elon's ownership when I got kicked off, and I tried all these appeals and nothing happened. And then there was oh, every once in a while, this it would say, "Oh, you got to do this," or "This has got redone," and the bots aren't being as ruthless as they were. So I'd try again. Nothing would happen. I must try it 100 times over the course of the 2 years, because I'd come across something or see something that gave me the impression that Twitter was free speech, and it seemed like it was free speech. I was just stuck in this weird box where it's like, you know, I would appeal, and my like appeal denial would come within like a millisecond. You know, like by the time I could shut down Twitter from putting in the appeal and go and open up my email inbox, the email was already there. No way, dude, you're not getting back on Twitter. And then Trump got inaugurated, and I didn't even appeal. And I was just lying in bed 2 days after the inauguration, and I got an email that said, "We reinstated your Twitter account."
Weird.
And then it was like 2 weeks after that, YouTube was like, they didn't just remonetize me, but they sent an email saying that we were, or us, I should say us, they sent an email that we were eligible to apply for monetization again. And then our other YouTube channel that had been, the Grammerica Outlawed YouTube channel that had been completely deleted, I got an email from that one saying that I could reappeal the deletion of the channel. So we all did that. We got all the channels back. That was the same month as Trump took office. And then, or maybe not got inaugurated. Maybe it's a difference between inauguration and when you take over. It was when he took over anyway. He gives
that's the inauguration, I'm pretty sure. But yeah, or right there anyway. I mean, that's the official moment when he's supposed to take over, right?
Yeah, it doesn't seem to, because we've been kicked off everywhere. Kindle, ACX, all these other platforms.
MySpace. Yeah,
and Kindle, I've tried a few times, but whatever hasn't trickled through to Amazon yet. Because, and you know what's funny with Kindle is they called us anti-Semitic. Because we were just publishing all these old historic books, right? And I tried to publish Henry Ford's one because, you know, why wouldn't you? Why? It's like a historic book that's, because from our point of view, it's all these books are going to disappear. You know, if they don't get updated into the new thing, they're going to disappear. History gets forgotten, blah, blah, blah. So we don't really have a take on it. We're just publishing all this old stuff. You know, it comes along, and we tried to publish one of Ford's books, and they freaked out, deleted the account. And now, I mean, the amount of actual anti-Semitic stuff I see on all of the social media platforms on a daily basis is just like, man, you kicked our account off for just like trying to reproduce a best-selling book.
Yeah, it's pretty insane, but it's funny, like you're saying, it seems so idealistic, and so I wasn't trying to put that up there. Sorry about that. I was just trying to get something ready. But it just seems funny the way that they just kind of run with whichever direction the wind blows, and because of that, I mean, you know, politics, it's inherently like, you know, I have a friend that calls me a YouTube whore, and it's a joke, right? But I do get where he's coming from. You know, you're stuck basically doing whatever YouTube tells you to do. You follow, like we were just saying, follow the algorithm, you're kind of its bitch. But when you're in politics, I mean, there is no, you know, it's sink or swim. There's no, you know, second place doesn't do you much good in any of these events. You know, there's plenty of room in YouTube or on the internet, in the podcast space or whatever, to make different content. And, you know, you can be 35th in your sphere and still be doing fine. But as a politician, you know, it ain't so fucking hot. And so these guys, I mean, it's like you watch the way Obama and Hillary both just blew back and forth on the on gay marriage, or you watch the way that George W. went from like no war to, well, you know, fuck all that, let's just blow up everybody. And it's, you know, it's even his dad when he's like, oh, we're gonna go take out Saddam Hussein, and he's like, yeah, well, you know what, it'd sure be nice to be able to come back here in 20 years, you know, let's go home, da-da-da-da-da. We'll come back in 10. But you know, it seems like these politicians just kind of chase whichever direction the wind blows, and it's pretty unfortunate. It's pretty frustrating.
Yeah, it seems to be like at least the entertainment division is doing that, you know, while the MIC sort of marches forward in the background towards totalitarianism. But the puppets in the front office are just sort of, what do you guys want to see? But the only sort of pushback I would have on that would be that it never the wind never blows back into the barn. You know what I mean? It's like the doesn't matter who's in power. We never get any of those lost freedoms back. Might be, and I'm not even saying we've got it back yet, because I still haven't ruled out that it's not some sort of honeypot or trap, or they figure out that they're better to have us crazy assholes online instead of, you know, tucked away in chat rooms or something. I haven't, because it's still sort of fresh and the cancel culture was so hard for a while. I haven't ruled out that it's not a trap yet.
Oh, well,
if it's not, that's got to be like in my lifetime, one of the first times that like totalitarianism has rolled back on something. I can't really think of another example in the last 50 years where this sort of totalitarianism ball has rolled back on something, and censorship might be one of those. But at the same time as that's happening, people are getting arrested in the UK and soon to be Canada for posting stuff on those platforms.
Exactly. You know, in America, it's one of the things that, you know, there's not a whole lot of things. I won't stand there and beat my chest about how great our country is, because there's a lot of things in America that I really am not a fan of. But there is one, the freedom of speech and the skepticism of the government that's instilled into the fabric of society, at least in blue collar society, is really important. And it has a lot to do with, I think, about just the way that the country reacts to things, and some for better or for worse, you know. Really quick, you mentioned hidden, like the way that they hide stuff. And I want to show this before I start addressing a couple of things the chat's talking about. But this was that top map. These are both maps of the distribution of artificially modified craniums throughout the world. There's elongated skulls, right? This is where they find them throughout the planet. Now, the top map is from 1938, and the bottom map is from 2016. And the top map has all these islands in the Pacific and big chunks of the inland Northwest, or the inland United States, and a couple other spots that you see that the bottom map has omitted.
The bottom map is all elevation too. If I look at, I mean, maybe not exactly, but off the top of my head, looking at that, almost all that colored area has got some elevation to it.
Well, that's a good point. I didn't even think of that. But no, these are both supposed to represent the same thing. They're both supposed to show where you find elongated skulls in the record. But the one from 80 years ago has places that the one from 10 years ago doesn't. It's like, you know, they tell us that science learns more as we progress, but clearly here we're forgetting something. And like you were saying about things being hidden, there's not a lot of times that I'll just like point and say, aha, we got it. But that's a peer-reviewed published paper that 2016 map came from. So it wasn't just one or two guys that it went through. It was, you know, it had to get evaluated. So, it seems, especially when you look at the Pacific Islands, it's like they just forgot that they exist, Hawaii and Niue and all these places. And then you start looking it up and you find the same thing. It's all missing from the record, which is kind of crazy.
I was just on Rapa Nui.
Oh, man. Yeah, Rapa Nui, that's funnily enough, I just had that debate with Gnostic Informant on Matt Bell's Limitless channel, and him and Flint Dibble did a live stream afterwards, and I talked about Easter Island a little bit, and they talked mad shit about me not knowing anything. And it's like the fucking peer-reviewed published papers, they had a chance to do their research before they made their video talking about it. He got everything all prepared. Flint had his little clips all prepared, but he didn't bother to look. And it's like multiple times saying stuff that's just wrong. He's like, oh, that's not true at all. And it's like, well, here's the paper that just came out 2 years ago that proves that it is true. Here's the map that shows that that is true. It's like, good God, you guys.
I got to say, I think you and James Lindsay are the only two people that I really interact with that come with their own little like army of trolls behind you.
Yeah,
I interact with you. I can expect all these people to sort of tell me why I'm a piece of shit for interacting with you. It's kind of, it's interesting because yours are archaeologists. His seem to be mostly communists.
Oh well, I think if you made a Venn diagram, there'd be a pretty hefty overlap there.
But it might not look like your traditional Venn diagram.
No.
Well, I'd be interested in talking to your take on Rapa Nui because I was just there, and I mean, a lot of that stuff. It's hard to argue. I think it's hard to argue with sort of the maybe not the mainstream narrative, but at least. It seems to be sort of along those lines for the most part, with sort of a couple exceptions, in my opinion, at least anyway, with those exceptions being the wall on the one side. There's only one of them that I've seen anyway, that's very clearly the same as the stuff you see in Peru. And then the four basalt moais. The interesting thing about the four basalt, because all the other moais are like composite of basalt and something else that makes it a lot easier to carve, and you can actually see in the quarry where whether it's true or not, but the story Alejandro was telling us, and you can sort of see in the thing as they were carving this moai out of the quarry, and you can see where they hit a vein of pure basalt, and you can see that they sort of tried and stopped, and that's where they sort of gave up. But there was full solid basalt moais on the island. One of them is the one. Now, the interesting thing about the one that got taken to England is that one, I think it was about 3 meters tall. It's got the nipples on it. It's a little different, and it's made out of pure basalt or whatever, the hard kind of basalt, at least anyway, that they're not supposed to be able to carve. And it's the only moai that they found indoors. So they took this moai from the beach all the way up to the crater rim, dug a hole, buried it far down enough so that they could build a hut over top of it and put a roof on it. Seemingly, I don't think that they say this, but it seems to me like they were hiding it. And then the British show up. And the thing is, you go around and there's moais on the beach everywhere. Like right there, right by the water. And the British go up the hill and they go up to the one that's probably the hardest moai on the entire island to get down and take it out of this hut and bring it down and take it off to the British Museum, where I believe it still is today.
Yeah.
I think that's the sort of thing to me is that there's, because the other thing is that wall where has the perfectly interlocking rocks is also solid basalt. That's where the four moais were found. So I think that those moais were there when those people got there, and they were sort of emulating what they found there, because even their oral tradition seemed to lead that they found their way there after the, seems like the cataclysm. Their homeland was sinking. It was a cataclysm. They show up here, they find these moais, and it seems like they, and then from the time they find these moais, whenever that was, I think that's sort of their story about them making them and all that sort of stuff seems to be make the most sense to me, because you can see a lot of those moais are some of them have been hit by a tsunami and stuff like that. The other big thing I found is that the big takeaway I had was the way the hands go on the moai, the way all the hands are always across their navel there. I found a lot of that stuff in those statues they found at Göbekli Tepe. I mean, yeah, it's not moai, it doesn't look the same, but their hands are doing the exact same thing. Their fingers are sort of it looks, you'd have a real hard time convincing me that those things aren't connected in some way.
Yeah, Graham Langdon wrote a book that's The Mystery of the Navel Holding Statues. And he did a pretty good job of connecting where you've seen in all the way in Sardinia and in South America and all over the place, and where they show up, it almost always corresponds to the beginning of farming and or metallurgy. And that's kind of an interesting takeaway when you look at like some of them on Göbekli Tepe are grabbing their dick, right? Just straight up holding an erect cock, and other ones are holding their stuff. That's a Karan Tepe, I believe, actually. But and at Göbekli Tepe, you have some holding their stomach. It's like you think about the symbolism behind that. And it's like, if you don't have to hunt all day long, if you don't have to hunt and gather all day long, if you farm and so you have this surplus of time, sex becomes the first thing to do when there's no TV and no internet, right? So that symbolism, it's interesting. You noticed the same connection there. One of the things that
I think about the tepes too is it's really starting to look like those. I mean, if they really dug that whole top of that big old hill up, I feel like it's almost starting to look like that's a giant integrated complex.
Yeah,
they're all sort of tied in to a certain extent. It's getting hard to sell it's an altar or a temple or something like that thing. It's starting to seem like it's looking like a city, you know?
Yeah, so it's definitely looking like there was a lot more going on there. The thing that drives me nuts about Göbekli Tepe with the limited amount of excavation is the iconography there is so distinct and so unique that proto language stuff is, to me, it seems like a real good candidate for being a proto language or early written language. But you need more than 5% of the symbols in order to figure that one out. So, another thing about Easter Island that's interesting, one of the big ones to me actually is this thing called the World Navel, the Axis Mundi. It's the idea that's like this is the center of where the umbilical cord of God started creating the world, right? And it's usually a stone, like they had the Omphalos stone at Delhi, and then there's the Wailing Wall there, and then there's in Sacsayhuaman, and there's one in India, and they're always at like a cultural center. But at Easter Island, they've got one. And if you think Polynesia, it's like this is a far flung corner of their world. But if you look at a map of Polynesia here, no, not that. Let's add something else. Sorry, I'm not the biggest ninja in the world.
Yeah, and I mean the other thing, Easter Island's not really in the middle of nowhere when you go to Ice Age ocean levels.
That's exactly what I'm getting at. This is Easter Island, with the topography, and it's just right in the middle. It's actually in the middle of right. It's right before you cross the mid-Atlantic Ridge, and it's kind of like the last waypoint if you're coming from South America headed towards Asia. It's like would be a good stopping spot to load up on all your stuff. So, to me, it's pretty interesting that all these things coincide. But it's not proof of anything, clearly, but it doesn't have to, in my opinion, things don't need to be proof as much as they just, eventually you want to prove these things out and bear them out. But, the investigation along the way, a great way to taint your interpretation of the data is to be looking to find something.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Apparently I called that the Pacific instead of, or the Atlantic instead of the Pacific, but all right, really quickly, I want to address this if it's all right. I'm getting shit about hanging out with Billy Carson at these events and stuff. And it's like, I got to handle the first elongated skull that was ever on, Ancient Aliens. I've even got it.
Is that David Hatchett Childress?
Crystal Skull, excuse me. But yeah, I got to meet David Childress.
He's one of the OGs.
Dude, yeah, he gave me some books and stuff, but like, hey, come on, here we go. Like that's, that the woman that let me check this out, she says that I'm the first person that is a self-proclaimed skeptic that she's let me in the same room with it, let alone handle it. And Carolyn was really nice, and she let me, she actually like doesn't like people to stick their fingers in the eye sockets, but I wasn't aware, and I'm feeling for tool marks and stuff, and so I'm at one point she's just like, please, blow. You know, she takes it real, she's very spiritual and takes it real serious. And I'm not so spiritual and didn't take it very serious as far as, I can't say I didn't take it very serious. I don't have the same beliefs as she does. Not even close. But because I treated it with respect and treated her beliefs with respect and didn't just tell her you're a stupid woman that thinks that this stupid skull, blah, 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 because that's not what I think. I think that, you know, everybody's got different life experiences. And so, like, the things that change the way I view the world, everybody's had things that changed the way they view the world. Like, one to me was when I saw, like, I saw a face looking at me through a window. And it was just a hallucination. It was just caused by, I just watched a movie and the face looked like it was in the same suit as the movie. And there was wavy glass and fog on the window. And I turned and ran out of the room instead of doing this and breaking the image, you could have never convinced me there wasn't a person staring at me. And so that happened when I was 10, and that changed the way I viewed a lot of things. I realized at that point my senses can really fuck with me. I can see something. I mean, this dude looked like he was angry at me. I still call him a dude because in my head it was a human looking at me, but I know it wasn't. So that experience changed the way I view the world. So my point is that other people have had different experiences, and you know, you can. There's things that are empirical, but they fall short of defining everything. Now, there's a lot of things that they're the best answer for, but there's a lot of things that, well, let's put it this way. I can't imagine, there's not one dystopian reality that I've ever read about it, dystopian fiction, that doesn't rely on some removal of emotion, some removal of humanity, making it all empirical. We know that that's scary shit.
Ayn Rand.
Yep. Fucking Sarah Connor. She says it took the Skynet like 0.02 seconds to determine our fate. And like once it became self-aware, it knew right away what the fuck to do with us. And I mean, that's we know this, right? Like we are aware that removal of humanity, removal of emotion, removal of imperfection is the beginning of is horrible. This is an inhuman, but like, so to me, the people that try to look at things through purely empirical ways, and well, they don't end up sitting in the room with a crystal skull, and to circle back to it, they don't end up sitting in the room with Billy Carson. And while some people say, hey, this Dave guy is telling me that I shouldn't give him a place at the table, it's like, bro, Billy had a place at the table fucking 10 years before I was doing any of this stuff. All right. So I don't know what to tell you on that. Anyway,
seems like a nice enough guy.
Oh, Billy's a great guy. I don't agree with a huge chunk of what he says. He doesn't agree with a huge chunk of what I say. Same with the lady with Carolyn and her skull. If we all agreed with everybody on everything, we wouldn't advance our knowledge. And if we can't, if we can't sit in a room and have a discussion, a serious, respectful discussion with people that you disagree with, well, I mean, just from a purely political perspective, we're fucked, right? This whole give them an inch, they'll take a mile thing does not work with any sort of democratic system whatsoever. You can't vote. And a great example of this is when they passed the gun laws in the early 80s, the assault weapons ban. They just had that shit that went, and excuse me, in the early 90s, they just had that shit that went down in LA when they had the big shootout. Those dudes in body armor in the middle of the street, and they're shooting it out with the cops, if you remember that. And there was a couple of other big high-profile shootings, and the NRA knew there ain't no fucking way you're going to stand up against the wave of public opinion and stop some sort of bill coming through and fucking with this stuff. So they focused on putting a 10-year limit on it. That was all. And you know, back then you couldn't buy a 30-round magazine for your AR, but you can again today. It was a smart political move. It was basically appeasing the masses, taking all the piss and vinegar out of all the momentum out of the movement. You guys won. 10 years later, they still can't get it back. You know, it's been 25 years now. So that was old school politics. Now it's just fighting the street. So
seems to be.
Yeah,
that's funny. I kind of came into the show the same sort of, because we've been doing this. I think we'll be. I think our anniversary is actually in a couple of days. I forgot, but we'll be 13 years June 1st will be our 13-year anniversary. And I kind of came into it mostly from your side, fairly skeptical. I was definitely the skeptical side of the show, probably not quite as skeptical as you on some things. But, you know, after doing it for as long as you can, I'd say sort of the two main takeaways I came away that changed for sure were, I mean, because I came into the show, I was an atheist. And then after interviewing 1,000 people on all sorts of different stuff, and sometimes it's not even the shows on spirituality that, you know, it's just a throwaway line here or a throwaway line there. But over the course of the show, I had to abandon the atheism. And then the other sort of main thing I ended up focusing on was the cataclysm stuff. It's like, I don't know who's right. Is it Randall? Is it Ben Davidson? Is it who's, I don't know whose model is right, but there seems to be, everywhere I go, there seems to be tons of evidence of global catastrophe. So that's sort of where I find myself dabbling the most these days, is poking into that stuff, because there's more with the LIDAR and all these new software tools and stuff like that. We can really dig into that stuff. And I don't know that we can ever figure out exactly what happened until it happens again. And at that point, we probably won't care. But that's the other sort of thing. And over the 13 years and traveling around to all these places, it's like some shit went down that on a scale that we can't comprehend.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you on that. It's, there's signs of like massive destruction around the world, right? And depending on where you go, it seems even repeatedly, like you could find, you find the stories everywhere is one thing, but then you find, you know, things like the Carolina Bays, for example. That was something that I was completely unaware of until about a year and a half ago. And that was really interesting stuff. It's like, you know, I haven't got to dig into it as much as I'd like to. But I think, you know, from my perspective, I always end up focusing on, I get frustrated because I'd still would call myself an atheist, even though I would, I'd have a lot of atheists that would wag their finger at me and say, you're not an empiricist enough to be in our camp, but that's fine. It pisses me off when I look at something like the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, and I see two warring camps of scientists. It's like when it gets down to the point where emotion is clearly involved, I know that the scientists aren't doing their jobs right anymore. They're clearly not being scientists. They're being, you know, pundits for a fucking position. And at that point, I can't trust the data. All right. No more than I can trust the data than it comes from any ideologue. I don't, you know, if you come to me and you've got all these gun statistics, but you're trying to push a agenda one way or the other, I don't trust your statistics. I have to go look under the hood myself. And that's really frustrating when it's something specialized like fucking isotopes and ice cores and shit, right? You got a handful of people on the entire planet you can talk to about this stuff. So,
then you got this whole replication issue at the same time. It's like, how much of this stuff can you even replicate? I mean, how much of this stuff that we take for granted is real?
No. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's... When you start talking about the replication side of things, that's where archaeology just fails as a science miserably. It's, I mean, that's one of the places, but it's, you know, archaeology it does a lot of sciencey things, but it's, you know, historians are smart enough to not call themselves scientists. When archaeology, I'm sorry?
Have you been to Egypt yet?
I wish. No, I've still got to. My son graduates next year, so I'm probably going to do the big traveling then.
We're going to do one, I think. We're going to do, we're sort of in the background percolating an Egypt trip. But the reason I bring it out is because even on there's a couple places, I want to say the Assyrian and the Giza Plateau are the two big ones. And when I say Giza Plateau, I'm saying like, I think it's the smallest pyramid. I can't remember what that one's called. But when you go to the smallest pyramid on the Giza Plateau, and when you go down, I can't remember if it's Dendera or which temple it's behind, buried underneath, but it's the Assyrian anyway. Everyone's seen pictures of it. Those are the two sites in Egypt that you go there, and you can clearly see that the pyramids weren't done. I don't know if the big two were done. Maybe they were done. I think there's evidence that the two big ones were done and had the capstones or whatever they're, you know what I'm talking about, the sheeting put on them. I mean, the stuff you can still see at the top of the Khafre pyramid. But you go to the small one, and the casing stones weren't done. They're only about, they're like a third of the way up, maybe even less than that. And you can go around on all four sides. And I wish I had the pictures handy. I didn't plan to talk about this, but you can go around on all four sides. And there's some of them still got the nubs on them. Some of them still, they're all very bubbly. And then when you go to dead center of the four sides there, you can go to the thing. And right at the bottom, there's a spot there that's about 20 feet by 20 feet. I'll pull up a picture when I have a second, when you start talking again. And there's a spot there that's about 20 feet by 20 feet. That's completely smooth. And you can see where the ridge comes up, where the scrape ended or the grind ended or whatever they were doing. You can see where that clearly ended, and you get back into the bubbly rock. And it's like you got one on each side of this pyramid. It almost seems like as a builder in construction, it's like when I go to a job site, you're going to have some benchmarks on each side. Hey, here's our, this is the finished product. We got one on each side. Now we can set our strings off that or do whatever we got to do to make sure we're in line. And the other one you go to is the Assyrian. And in the top, I don't know which directionally, which way that would be. But if you in the back corner of the Assyrian, you can see, and I'll find some pictures here in a second, but you can clearly see where the rocks are not finished, all of them. But you can see in one corner where they started finish them. And there's two different grind patterns, grind, scoop, scrape, whatever they were doing. There's a vertical one, and there's a horizontal one as well. I'll pull the tools up, but when you go there, you can see like they weren't done. They were like the Snake Bros, their presentation, I think, is called Unfinished, because it's like you go to these places and it's almost like they were in the middle of doing it and the shit went down. They had to stop. Whether the food system collapsed and they had to stop, whether there was a catastrophe and they had to stop, whether it's like an amalgamation of those things kind of playing out slowly in the background and it slowly comes through a thing, but the pyramids weren't finished. The Assyrian wasn't finished. And I think we sort of find this evidence all over the world where they were, it seems to me like they were building, because I don't accept the age of the pyramids that they've given us. It seems to me like they were building and preparing for something, maybe. Like they knew something was coming. I mean, yeah, I had never really thought about the tightness of the stones on, you know, because we always go back and forth. It's like if you can get these huge stones and you can get them to fit that perfectly and you do it, it's either super easy for you, it's not a big deal, so you just do it because it's easy, or I would argue it's important. It's important to the point that whatever effort you're putting into, because it's not super easy, is worth doing that effort. And I was talking to the ethical skeptic, and he was talking about it. He's like, well, if you can imagine like where you can get like the wind and the water and everything riled up to such a place that you've got like horizontal rain coming in. He's like, if you've got a traditional wall there, if that hydrology finds any sort of an inroad, if it starts getting in anywhere, it's going to channelize it all out and your wall will eventually fail. I mean, how we get horizontal rain and that sort of stuff, you know, that gets into his pole flip stuff, which I don't think we need to really get into here, but it's just like it was the first real good explanation I've got for why it would have been so important to have all that stuff fit together so tight, because you knew water was going to be in play somehow. And we all know what water does. If water if you give water an inch, it's going to take a mile.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's interesting. I hadn't heard that about about as a hypothesis for why they had the stones fitting so tight. But that is a good point. I need to thank No Borders really quick for the Egypt money. He donated $10 so that I can go to Egypt.
We'll get you to Egypt eventually. Like I say, we're working on going back there with the crew. We're going back to Easter Island in 2028. Of course, we're going to Malta next year to look at Malta, Sardinia, and Sicily.
Well, heck, you're taking. I'm going to your deal just in a little bit. You're going to Serpent Mount.
That's right. Surf them out in like 2-3 weeks, I guess, right?
Yeah, yeah. Just for the, yeah, like 3 weeks for the solstice.
3 weeks to surf them. That's going to be a good one. Have you met Dave Matheson or Brandon Powell yet?
I don't believe I have.
Yeah, it'll be a good one. Have you done any cold plunging yet?
Any what?
Like ice tanks. That's what Brandon Powell does. He was like the second or third person in North America to get certified by Wim himself. So he's buddies with Wim. Wim certified him. So he's a certified Wim Hof coach. And he does like this breath work stuff that is wild. I mean, he gets you going in the morning and he'll get everyone sort of picks out a patch of floor and you lie on the floor, you lie on your back, and he gets you going through all this breath work stuff. I won't try and do it because I'll just butcher it, but he's got a whole thing. It's very shamanistic where he's got beats going and some didgeridoo, and he's like doing this breath work with you, that you do these holds and these heavy breathing and stuff like that. And it is psychedelic, dude. Like, honestly, every time we do it with a new group of people, you'll see this time, I guarantee it'll happen. There'll be some people that are maybe crying. There'll be some people that are laughing. There'll be some people whose hands are shaking. There'll be some people who have to stop because it's too much. And it's this, I mean, the first time I really did it, you can sort of see what some of these shamans were up to. It's a real peek into, because I'm trying this for the second or third time. I'm not a shamanistic dude. You know, I'm just fucking around. I'm a little stoned still. You know, I got a bunch of coffee in me. And I can get this shit going on this weird sort of psychedelic state going. And it's like, if you could put like, you know, how X years into something like that, how far could you take it?
Yeah, that's interesting. Someone sent Dan some DMT. No, I don't need any DMT. Machu Picchu. Yeah. Timmy's talking about Machu Picchu. Timmy's a stud. Yeah. I haven't had a chance to get really anywhere out of the country yet. I'm pretty much gonna have to wait until my kids graduated from school. But then, yes, yeah, places where you can have weed with your coffee would definitely be more fun than places that you can't. Dude,
so we picked that Easter Island Moai as our logo, smoking a joint for the Grimerica show like 13 years ago. Mm-hmm. No, I didn't really know anything about Easter Island, knew about the Moais and stuff like that. Yeah. Just sort of a cool thing. And we got to Chile and started asking some people about weed on Weed Island. Or sorry, weed on Rapa Nui. Because we had met some guys in Chile. It's decriminalized, so they were trying to sell us some weed. And I was like, well, can I take it to Easter Island? And he's like, dude, no. Because Easter Island, at all the places I've gone, one of the hardest places to go to. Like when there's a special customs to get there, and you got to have all this paperwork, your flight information in and out, your hotel receipt, your guide, this, every like a stack of paper like that big to get in. So he's like, nah, he's like, you won't get it in. He's like, it's not, they don't even care about the weed. It's just that it's a vegetable. They don't want any weird shit out on that island. But we got out there, dude, there's weed everywhere. They say they call it Weed Island. That's like a little inside joke in Chile.
Oh, wow.
And we just had a Moai smoking a joint as our logo, just as a weird coincidence.
Well, I talked to a dude like 20 years ago, and he told me that he, like, don't plan on getting any drugs at all on Easter Island, especially weed. Not especially weed, but weed was one of them. So that's interesting. I'd heard that it was impossible to find there. Maybe he just looked for it.
It was very interesting. Let me share a screen here. Let me see if this works.
Down the
there, I got it down there. So maybe you just have to show it.
Darren Grant, here we go. Bam.
So this is that at the center of one side of the small pyramid. You can sort of see this picture here. This is that sort of spot where you can see the stones removed there.
Mm-hmm.
Here's another picture of it there, where this part here is perfectly smooth. There's one of these on each of the four sides. It's about 15-20 feet tall, 15-20 feet wide. And it's not a small amount. I mean, you can see that, like, this, I don't know if you can see my mouse, but this here is like 18 inches in some places.
Oh, wow.
And then you can really see it here where they've just sort of, it almost seems like they've scraped it off, grinded it off. I don't know, but this is just a flat portion, like a working surface on one side. And then I've got this one here. Hopefully there's nothing weird in my email. This is down in the Assyrian. Where to me, at least, it seems like I can see, it seems like there's a vertical tool working here that's about this wide. You can see between these two marks. But there also seems to be a rounded edge here where you've got some horizontal tooling at the same time. It sort of looks like you got something coming this way. And the reason I say that is because if you look at this vertical tool mark here, if you look down on this layer of rock, it's a little rougher still.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look right above that on these two rocks where you've got this round on this far side of it, you don't have that down here, right? You've only got it up here. This is clear. And when you're there, you can really see it. This is way smoother than right here. So it starts to look like you've got one tool that's come down here and got it to this good. And then, I mean, what it seems to me, and I think someone just said it in the chats, is when you're there, because the only work done in this entire Assyrian is in this one little corner. It's like, because you do construction, it's like that's where they had the fucking scaffold set up.
Yeah. That's
the scaffold was there. They had a big belt sander. I don't know what they had going on, but they were, that you can see this was their working service. So they've built this Assyrian. They've got whatever stored in there. It seems like they were stashing stuff in it. There's a bunch of little rooms. They say were little temple rooms. When I go there, it seems more like, you know, I'm looking at all from compound or bunker or something like that is what sort of my take on where I've come these days is it really starts to seem like a lot of this megalithic stuff, even maybe Göbekli Tepe, all of it was from a culture that knew they were fucked.
No, that's quite possible. It's an interesting idea that they basically these are shelters, because like Darren Kuyu was
maybe a shelter. Not even shelters, maybe like arcs. Like, I mean, if you're having something like that, it's like we can't get through it, but we can cram all our scrolls in here. We can cram maybe some seeds in here. We can just, you know, try and, you know, whereas it seems like today, what we're, if it's happening now, and some people think we're leading into another one of these sort of things, it seems like their plan is to just steal the money and let the rich people try and eke through it, you know, with the underground military bases, and they're stealing so much money, who knows what they're doing it. But it's like, that's where our culture's at. They're just like, if they knew, they wouldn't tell us. Whereas it seems like whatever this ancient culture was, there seemed like their idea of the best way to deal with it was to try and build giant things that might survive so that idiots like us could maybe figure it out.
Yeah. I'm more of the opinion myself that that it was like the kind that it seems like there was that the knowledge would get refound, and I don't really know how, or but you see this around the world where it kind of seems like there's a multiple, like where they just kind of pick up stone building, like or they end up like with the Osirian, for example. Like from my understanding, there's Greek graffiti on it that's like sacred geometry shit and whatnot, and that would make sense because the Greeks would look at it and marvel too. And that's one thing to keep in mind, in my opinion, is that these guys were people that were came into on the scene 1,000-2,000 years after the Egyptians, were blown away by what the Egyptians had done, and so. And there's only a few edifices that really qualify for that, and then a few things that are described that we haven't found yet. But if they exist at all, knock on wood. But it's just interesting to me anyway. It seems more like there was like this knowledge that was almost destroyed with the cataclysm, and then the people that were passing it down. We're basically putting it as part of a myth with the gods kind of thing. I don't know if you read Charles Hapgood's book.
Poles or the other one? He's got two, right? There's Path of the Poles, and the other one is Earth Shifting Crust.
Yes, and I'm mistaking authors really quick. Somebody said Have Good in the chat, and I got mistaken. It was that DeSantillo, whatever the fuck that name is. It's the one. We don't draw such a blank on it. It's the one that's about Hamlet's Mill. There's the name.
Oh, Hamlet's Mill. Yeah.
You read that one?
Yeah, we had. Yeah.
That kind of idea of encoding the knowledge and stuff to me seems. It seems like that, you know, at that point, you almost don't have to have, you know, the technology doesn't need to have been passed down so much as the understanding of how to do these things. I mean, one thing that, doesn't explain how the ground is stone so flat necessarily. We know how you can make flat stones with lapping, but that's not going to be like, you're not going to do that on tens of thousands of stones.
Well, even if you could, to me, that's not even the impressive thing is the jointing. I mean, you look at some of it and it's like, what the fuck?
Well, you can make flat edges on stone by just rubbing two pieces of stone together. Like that's how they make precision granite tabletops. But so it's like, that is a way to make these perfectly fitted stones, but you end up on the scale of like you're all of a sudden you're talking, you know, and going from hundreds of thousands of man hours to billions of man hours. You're just like, whoa, these guys had to spend so much time, because I mean they can use a small stone and they do it now and they'll lap, but it's like it takes forever. I think that you know, for millions of years, like hominids were using stone as a premier building material, as a premier weapon making material. Like this is what we made things out of, was stone. And you know, there's a lot of little tricks that got passed from father to son for millions of years that kind of just got erased when metal hit the scene. It's I compare a lot of times to like, how much do you know about horseback riding compared to your great-great-grandpa, right? It didn't take long at all for the knowledge to just to disappear. And so I think if we watched them build the pyramids, I don't think that we'd be like, holy shit, look at that. I think we'd be more like, holy shit, are you fucking kidding me? These guys, why the hell didn't I think of that? I think that would be more along those lines. Is it something that's almost so obvious and right under our nose, but there's a lot of things like that. I don't know if you know much about baseball, but like if you don't know anything about baseball, you know, why somebody saying you're a left-handed player can't play any infield positions but first base and pitcher. Well, that's just being fucking prejudiced against lefties. But it's like, no, it's the way the game is. You look at the field, look at where the throwing arm is, look at where their catching mitt is. They have to be, this is a position a lefty can play. Sorry. So it just takes a little bit of insight and you see more than, you see something that's obvious.
And so, abundance.
And abundance.
Like the amount of abundance you need to put those sort of man hours into something, I think, is tough to do fishing and hunting things.
Oh, dude. And then, the 20 years, like people, we're getting some comments in the chat about a 20-year pyramid construction timeline. And that, you know, I refer to that often as the gateway drug to becoming a pyramidiot. You just tell anybody that's got a tool belt, and, oh, yeah, they said these guys believe that the pyramid was built in 20 years. They're like, oh, fuck, okay. What other explanations do we got? Because clearly these guys are smoking crack. I mean, aliens sound more plausible at that point, in all honesty. It's like you tell and aliens are pretty implausible, in my opinion.
You could look at the outside and say 20 years, but go crawl around inside it for a couple hours and then tell me, go look through those shafts that are going through all this stuff. And it starts to be, I mean, I smoked dope in the Queen's Chamber. Speaking of smoking weed, I blew it out that little shaft out there.
Yes, and that's that's what the shafts are for. Ventilation. Exactly. So but no, it's funny, though. It's like, I haven't been there, but still looking at the size of the thing, I've seen pictures and whatnot, and then I've seen enough construction projects, and then, that 20-year stuff is crap. Yeah, I've seen Night Scarab videos on, Night Scarab's first video in particular on the construction of the pyramid, and it's white-collar trash. It's the kind of stuff that people come up with on paper and they're like, oh, when I ask how to square the pyramid, and they're like, oh, well, you just use the 3-4-5 method. You're like, okay, well, that works great on paper. Now, how are you going to do it with ropes that sag in the wind and then the humidity and in the sun? How are you going to get it down to this level of accuracy?
Oh, you need paper. You need paper, I think. There's no way you're building that stuff without prints.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we have trouble building stuff with prints half the time. To build it without, I mean, I think the main thing is just none of that stuff would have made it this far. You know, there's no pieces of paper from 10,000 years ago.
Oh, no. No, yeah. No, what I'm saying is there's a difference in planning it on paper and executing it on the field. I can plan stuff in paper and you know, like you could do a football play on paper and it works great. And then you go out and run it in the field. It's like, oh, fuck, that didn't work so hot. And it's, you know, this is just kind of how it is. The Night Scarabs video, if you haven't seen it, he claims that the pyramid could have been built in as little as 9 months. And, yeah, so, you know, smoke a little bit. Do what?
Just giving her.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's got this goofy little Mario. It looks like something from Donkey Kong, this girder system and lifting ramps and all this stuff. And it's like it's these kinds of systems that like OSHA just takes one look at. And they just throw you in prison for even suggesting. It's like, no, you're going to have a pile of bodies at the end of the first day, you bonehead.
And you got to build the system, even if you could build it. You probably got however long of building the system. What's your take on, because the other sort of smoking gun for me in a lot of this is the boneyards, the sort of stuff in Alaska where you've got this collection of creatures piled into one spot. Seems like some of it got pretty fucked up on its way there. And then you've got, there's a cave in Scotland, the name escapes me, but it's in Hapgood's book where he's got like, he was almost planning out a timeline based on these epochs of when, because his whole argument in the book was like, he's like, there's no way that a lion, a tiger, a bear, and a wildebeest all crawled into this cave. There's no way that happened. So yeah. Eventually he had kind of the thing that this stuff's getting washed in, and then when the water recedes, it gets left in. But he had found like layers from a couple different epochs sort of stacked on top of each other that led him to believe it was cyclical.
Yeah, and Hapgood's work was interesting. The Earth crust displacement thing, ultimately, I do think is wrong, but I do think like the kind of observations, like you were just showing observation among the Assyrian, that I have never seen anybody except for alternate historians point that out. I've never seen a mainstream Egyptologist go check out this little portion here that they finished that looks really weird, and then we don't know why they didn't finish the rest. I've seen them talk about the casing stones and how they're partially finished, but you know, again, it's always the same explanation. That doesn't add up with our 20-year timeline. We'll just put it that way. You get to the Egyptologists and archaeologists that are my lovers or haters that you have, you want to call yourselves, the guys that can't sleep without thinking about me. I have a question. I'm more of a statement. Pick one. Copper tools. 20 years. You fucking cannot have both. All right. The two to put together, that's insanity. All right. That is insanity.
That'd be 20 years just to do that little portion I showed you.
Thank you. Yeah. It's ridiculous. But it's alternate historians are all, like, they can be wrong a lot. Hapgood was wrong about a number of things, in my opinion, but he was also brought a lot of things to the forefront. And, that's, you know, the case that I use for this a lot is the guy Carl Christian Rafn. He was the anthropologist that figured out that the Norse discovered the Americas before Columbus. And the way he figured it out was eventually he read the actual reports from the explorers. But what got him to look for that was he thought that Native Americans were too stupid to carve on rocks. So whenever he would see a glyph, he was like, well, that couldn't have come from them dumb Indians. So who made this glyph? I must have been Vikings. So his whole line of evidence was pissing straight up a rope, but it still led him to something that we all learn today. So As long, in my mind, as long as the person is doing honest research, that's really the difference. If they're doing honest research, then they're going to bring data to bear. And even if they're wrong, like I think that Ben Van Kirkwick takes it too far with the ancient high technology, but he's definitely one of the guys pushing the measurements on the vases. If it wasn't for him, we wouldn't be talking about that. So, you know, it's
there's a little chunk for you.
Oh yeah, you got a little chunk of a vase. Oh nice, a little
chunk of I got that from underneath the bent pyramid.
Oh damn, you're trying to commit get yourself in trouble on my channel now.
Uh-oh, is that illegal? I've done it on my show a bunch of times. I mean, I don't know.
I don't know. Flint Dibble might show up at your front porch.
Flint Dibble.
He's my friend.
Seems like it.
Yeah, he's something else, but anyway. But yeah.
My presentation at the Serpent Mound has got some crust slip stuff in it, so I'll be curious to get your deconstruction.
Has got some what stuff in it? I'm sorry.
Some crustal slip stuff in it.
Oh yeah.
It's a little different than any of the stuff the other guys are spitting out right now, but sort of my own take on it. I'm going to unveil that at the Serpent Mound on the solstice. I'm doing a presentation there for the festival.
Yeah, that's going to be awesome. I really, really appreciate the invite. This will be a lot of fun.
It's going to be a blast. There's still a few spots left if people want to check that out. All the events are always available. Contact at thecabin.com.
Heck yeah. And all of your stuff is basically hubbed there. You're not YouTube, like you were saying earlier, you're not so much on YouTube as you are just kind of everywhere.
We're everywhere, yeah. I mean, the best spot to get our content is probably grimerica.ca. That if you go there, though, you can find the trips. You can find the we've done tons of audiobooks, trips, maps, all sorts of crazy stuff these days. It's fun. Keeps us busy.
Yeah, you guys have definitely been at it for a long time. Well, awesome.
13 years next week.
I'm sorry?
13 years next week.
Damn, dude. Nice.
Yeah, it's a while.
Well, yeah, thanks for showing up. Thanks, everybody, for watching and for commenting and all that. And you take it easy, man. We'll see you later.
Thanks.
We'll press this here button.